Hello and welcome to Prehistory, the Archaeology of the Ancient Near East. My name is Jane. Before we begin with the prehistoric record of people in the Near East, I thought it might be fun to start a little farther back with the origins of people. I'm not necessarily talking about humans, as humans, the species Homo sapiens, won't come into the picture here until the end of the episode. Today I want to talk more generally about people, the species which came before humans and evolved either to become our ancestors or our ancient aunts, uncles, and cousins. They may not have been human, but we can think of them as people. This is not exactly a short prologue, and in a way will cover more specific time than the entire duration of the archaeology of the Near East. However, as this is supposed to be a Near Eastern archaeology podcast, I'm squeezing all of the human evolutionary sequence into this one episode. This means shrinking down a large and complicated field, which is full of its own debates and continuous discoveries, so that we can have an idea of what happened with people before people became humans, without me letting myself get distracted doing an entire podcast series worth of prologue. There is an occasional saying that if you put together all of the fossils which we have found from our pre-human ancestors, you could fit them all onto a desk. Really, we have more than that, but we're not exactly swimming in well-preserved and complete skeletons. There are some nearly complete and well-preserved skeletons, but mostly we have individual bones or bits of bones. Being so rare, each bone is studied in detail to see what known species it may belong to, how it may be different, and how all the bones belonging to a species might tell us how each person walked, ate, socialized, and generally lived. Also, being so rare, the archaeologists studying these bones do what archaeologists do best. We argue. I don't know how many archaeologists you know, and if you know a lot, you will undoubtedly know just how weird we are, but we are an argumentative lot. I'm not saying that we pick fights with people on the street, but we can have very different interpretations of how things happened in the past. Where there is a gap in what we know about the past, then the number of theories about what happened in that gap will be greater than one. Even if there is only one archaeologist studying a particular aspect of the past, it will still be greater than one because we can even manage to argue with ourselves until we've found evidence which can tell us which, if any, of our ideas is the right one. At which point, we move on to another missing piece of the puzzle, and the arguments begin again. It's fun. Anyway, as you may have expected, our story begins in Africa. Somewhere on the very large continent of Africa, about 8 to 5 million years ago, we had a common ancestor with both chimpanzees and gorillas. Based upon things which we have in common with chimpanzees and gorillas, we can guess a few things which this species might have been able to do. This was probably a social primate, with its eyes facing forward with binocular 3D vision, and possibly with the ability to stand and walk for short periods. This still unknown common ancestor evolved into at least two new species, which may have lived together in the same part of Africa or may have lived in very different areas. One species became the root of the evolutionary tree that turned into chimpanzees and gorillas, and the other became the base of our evolutionary tree. There are a few contenders for this early branch of our family tree. The oldest of these is Sahelanthropus, or the man from the Sahel region, who was found about 20 years ago in Chad. The skull which was found is 6 to 7 million years old and is about the same size as the skull of a chimp, with the same sort of sloping face. His teeth, though, are small compared to a chimp, specifically the canine teeth. Chimps and gorillas have noticeably large, fang-like canines. Humans have little canines that lie almost level with the other teeth. Sahel man has small canines for the size of his body. They're not as small as ours, but they're noticeably smaller than those of a chimp. The big difference, though, is that Sahel man may have stood upright. We know that because the hole where his spine enters his skull is on the bottom of the skull, like it is in humans, rather than at the back of the skull, like it is in chimps and gorillas. We don't have his pelvis or his legs, though, so it's difficult to tell how upright he would have been in the sense of being able to walk around on just his feet. Another possible ancestor is Auroran, or original men, from Kenya, who lived 5.8 million years ago. Unlike with Sahel man, we have more parts than just the skull, which is good because our one skull of original man is only a few fragments of jaws and teeth. However, we do have his legs. The top of the thigh bone, the femur, has a pattern of muscle attachments for the hip joint, which shows that he also walked upright. Of course, we don't know if he did this all the time or how well. It has also been suggested that original man is a relative of Ardipithecus, another early maybe people group from about 5.6 million years ago, and is known at the earliest only from a few bits of skeleton and a few teeth. Ardipithecus is where I have to stop referring to our ancestors by only one name. Sahelanthropus, Auroran, and Ardipithecus are not the whole species names, but give the genus, or closely related group of species. This is like how we humans are Homo sapiens, but there are, or rather, there were, other related species in the genus Homo. A way that I like to think about this is that horses, donkeys, and zebras are all part of the genus Equus, but each is a different species. With Ardipithecus, the genus name here meaning basal ape in the sense of being at the base of our evolution, we have multiple different species. The oldest of these, the one dated to 5.6 million years ago, is Ardipithecus cataba. Much of what we know about him comes from a later relative called Ardipithecus ramidus. The remains of Ardipithecus ramidus, which we have, date to 4.4 million years ago and come from multiple individuals, including more than 100 individual bones. Now, I say that these are the dates of the remains which we do have because, as with every potential ancestor species, we don't exactly know when they first evolved or exactly when they died out. Only a time range from which we found their remains. We may have found the oldest individuals of the species, or the last, or somewhere in the middle. Because we have multiple sets of remains, we have more body parts overall for study and can get a better idea of how Ardipithecus might fit into the human family tree. Ardipithecus, we'll call him Ardi for short, also walked upright and was small. His head, and therefore his brain, was about one-fifth the size of a modern human, and he stood about 120 centimeters, or just under 4 feet tall. Ardi also had the forward-projecting face similar to chimps that was found with Sahelmen, and also smaller canines like those of Sahelmen. His teeth suggest that he was an omnivore, meaning that he had a varied diet and didn't specialize in fruit or meat or any other single food source. Ardi's skull and pelvis both show that he would have been able to stand and walk upright, but his pelvis suggests that he probably wasn't very good at it. He certainly would not have been winning any races today, and he probably would have had difficulty joining you for an afternoon walk. His arms, legs, hands, and feet suggest that he was still pretty good at climbing trees, but he had evolved away from many of the tree-climbing traits that we see in chimps and gorillas. These studies of the preserved remains of the multiple Ardis that we found suggest that he is one of our most primitive ancestors, even if more bones are needed from Sahelmen and original man to figure out how they may relate to Ardi, to our common ancestor with chimps and gorillas, and to us. The significant jump from our primitive common ancestors to more human-like people came with the next group of ancestors, Australopithecus. Australopithecus means southern ape. As with Ardipithecus, we found more than one species of Australopithecus, and so here our family tree really starts to look more like a bush, with some species which seem to be our ancestors and other species which seem to have evolved a bit differently and probably are more like ancient cousins. The oldest Australopithecus which we know of at the moment is Australopithecus anamensis, which translates as the lakeside southern ape, who has been found in multiple parts of East Africa and who lived 4.2 to 3.7 million years ago. We only have fragments of anamensis, but these cover enough parts of the body to suggest that they walked upright full-time. However, as we don't have a skull or a partial skeleton, we cannot yet say how tall anamensis was or how big his brain was. The next Australopithecus that we know of is believed to have descended from anamensis and is also the most famous, Australopithecus afarensis, or southern ape of the Afar region, who lived about 3.8 to 2.9 million years ago and whose remains have been found all over Africa. I say the most famous because one of the most famous fossil skeletons ever found, Lucy, was an Australopithecus afarensis. Lucy was probably actually not the first afarensis found. Some bones found in the 1930s are now considered to belong to this species, but she was the most complete skeleton of any Australopithecine to be found and was part of the original description of the species. The team which found her in 1974 famously had a party back at their camp to celebrate having found such a fantastic skeleton. During the party, they played records, including the Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which contains the song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and this gave Lucy her name. Lucy was about 1.05 meters tall, or about 3 foot 5 inches, making her on the small end for her species, which went up to about 1.5 meters in height, or just under 5 feet tall. From the bones of afarensis which we found, the sexual dimorphism, the difference in size between males and females, was probably on about the same scale as what we see in humans. So they were probably about the same size, therefore, as Ardi. Afarensis, however, had noticeably bigger brains, about the third of the size of a modern human. They also had shorter legs relative to their bodies than humans do, which is something that all of the Australopithecines seem to share. They also had rounder and wider rib cages than we do. Apart from being very short, with short legs, afarensis would have looked very different from us, although still much more like us than like a chimp. Their skulls did not have the round shape that you get in humans. The next time that you are walking around down the street, or in a group of people, have a bit of a look around you. Humans have very round skulls, a lot like a ball with a little face stuck on the front. We have high foreheads, a big round brain case with a flattish back, and which slopes back inwards towards our little necks. Afarensis did not look like that. Afarensis, and all of the Australopithecines, had big eyebrows. I don't mean shaggy eyebrows with lots of hair. I mean big. There's a ridge of bone underneath the eyebrows, which is the eyebrow ridge. If you want to be fancy, it's the superorbital ridge. Superorbital just meaning above the eye. Anyway, the eyebrow ridge. In humans, this is a tiny little thing. Have a feel just at the top of your eyebrows. If you're driving, maybe wait till later. Close to the middle of your face, just near the top of your eyebrows, there should be a little bumpy line in the bone. In females, this is often practically non-existent, but it's a bit bigger in males, with a lot of range either way. In Australopithecines, the eyebrow ridge is not something you would have easily missed. It is a noticeable thick ridge that sticks out across the top of the eyes. We have eyebrows, but afarensis had eyebrows. They also had bigger faces than we do, or rather, they probably had a similar amount of face, but with less head for it to fit in. This face also stuck out more from the skull, with bigger noses and bigger jaws. That said, while I don't think that an afarensis walking around today would exactly blend in, they would be visibly a person, if a very odd-looking person. Afarensis also walked upright full-time and had lost a lot of traits for climbing trees, such as the wide-set big toe for grasping tree branches. Their fingers and toes were shorter than any other primate apart from members of the later genus Homo, including humans, although the bones of the fingers were still slightly curved and not flat like humans. If you put your hands flat on a table, again, if you're driving, maybe later, you can see that your palm and fingers can all lay flat in the line with no gaps between your fingers and the table. Afarensis would have had a slight gap between the fingers and the table because the first bone of each finger was slightly curved. This is an adaptation to tree climbing, which we see in other apes and which was still present in afarensis, even though their pelvis, knees, and feet tell us that they were walkers rather than climbers. So we have two camps in archaeology about afarensis. One group looks at the pelvis and the knees and argues that afarensis was a full-time walker and almost, but not quite as good at getting around on two legs as humans. The other camp looks at the hands and the feet and argues that there are still way too many tree-climbing traits and that afarensis probably spent more time in trees and only walked a bit on occasion. If you really want to annoy everyone, you can point out that these two arguments are not mutually exclusive. After about 3 million years ago, our picture becomes more complicated. One potential ancestor around for much of the same time as afarensis is Australopithecus africanus, meaning the southern ape of Africa. Africanus was found several decades before his ancestors, which is why he gets to have the better name. Based on fossils which have been found, Africanus lived probably 3.7 to 2 million years ago, at least in southern Africa, if not also in other parts. They may or may not have been part of our own evolutionary ancestry, as studies of their arms and legs suggest that the proportions are more chimp and gorilla-like than those of Africanus, and they may have been part of an evolutionary line which was heading back into more tree climbing, or they may have been a cousin of afarensis and part of an older split within Australopithecus. Also from at least 2.5 million years ago, there was Australopithecus gari, meaning the surprise southern ape, who was first found only in 1990 and is known from one and a bit skulls and probably also a partial skeleton. If the skeleton and the skull that was found near it come from the same individual, or the same species, then the proportions of the limbs of Gari are much more human-like than those of Africanus, Afarensis, and the other Australopithecines. However, we also seem to have a split at some point in the Australopithecine section of our evolutionary tree, or bush. Around this time, we also have other very different species of Australopithecus, known as the robust species, who have larger and stronger teeth, particularly larger molar and premolar teeth and comparatively small front teeth, with much larger jaw muscles and wider faces to accommodate these. The oldest of these is Ethiopicus, also known as Paranthropus Ethiopicus, Paranthropus meaning alongside man, who is found at least 2.7 to 2.3 million years ago. We also have Australopithecus / Paranthropus Bossae from 2.3 to 1.2 million years ago and Paranthropus / Australopithecus Robustus from 1.8 to 1.2 million years ago. This group of Paranthropus or Robustus Australopithecines is seen as a group of our cousins rather than as direct ancestors to humans. We also have another Australopithecine, Australopithecus sediba, who lived at least in southern Africa at least 2 million years ago, and who does not have the large teeth and jaws of the robust species, although sediba probably lived too late to be considered as a direct ancestor to humans. The Australopithecines form a wide body of species, found all over Africa, and were around as a group for at least 3 million years. If we think of Africa about 2.5 million years ago, we would certainly have had Africanus, Gari, and Ethiopicus alive at the same time, and we may also have had Sediba, Boisei already present, and may have had much older Afarensis still present. In addition to this, the number of potential ancestor or cousin species, which were around about 2.5 million years ago, is not limited to the Australopithecines. To complicate our evolutionary bush a bit farther, this is also the time when we see a new and very familiar family enter our evolutionary story. Homo habilis, or handyman, was also living in eastern and southern Africa, if not in other regions, by 2.4 million years ago, if not earlier. Habilis is the first species that we know of from our own genus of Homo. Our handyman was small, about 1 to 1.35 meters tall, or 3 foot 4 inches to 4 foot 5 inches tall. However, he gets placed in our own genus because of some specific differences that he has from Australopithecines. In humans, and in other members of our Homo genus, our molar teeth form a particular pattern. Have a look in the mirror. Not if you're driving. Look inside your mouth at your lower teeth. The three squarish teeth at the back of your mouth, your molars, have a pattern. The first molar, the one closest to your lips, is the largest. The second is a little smaller, and the third is a little smaller again. Australopithecines do not have this pattern. Their molar teeth are backwards to ours, with the first molar being the smallest and the third molar being the largest. Handyman's molars have our pattern, with the smallest at the back. Handyman also had a larger brain relative to his body size than the Australopithecines, about half that of a modern human. We have some bits of his postcranial skeleton, that is, the bits other than the head, which suggests that his arms and legs had proportions between them which are closer to those of humans. Because remember, Australopithecines had shorter legs relative to their height than humans. Although, as with so much of our evolution, there are some arguments about this. One of the big problems with handyman is that we're not sure if the bits which we found are all from one species. There is a lot of variation, and we don't have any nice skeletons like we had with Lucy, and there are several other species of people knocking around at the same time. So we have a hand here, and a foot there, and some limb bones somewhere else, but whether they all really do come from handyman is, well, still an argument. There is enough variation in handyman that it has been suggested that we actually have two species. The second of these, Homo rhodopensis, isn't well explained yet, and may not actually be a second species. If they did exist as a second species, they come later than handyman, a little less than 2 million years ago, and had slightly larger brains. As the jury is still out, I think we'll keep handyman as one species for now. What we do have of handyman's hands and feet, and a bit from the legs, suggests that handyman hasn't lost all of the tree climbing traits, such as curved finger bones and slightly different ankles. However, while he probably didn't walk as well as we do, and probably didn't run, we'll get to that, he probably was better on two legs than the Australopithecines. Handyman gets a lot of arguments about him because of what else he's known for. You might have guessed from the name, or you already knew and have been yelling at me to get on with it, but what Handyman is most famous for is making tools. Okay, I know that's not all that exciting, and right now you're probably saying, hang on, even chimps use tools. How is this new? But it is. The oldest intentionally made chipstone tools that we know of to date come from 2.6 million years ago. You may have spotted the problem here. Yes, Handyman was probably around 2.6 million years ago, and our oldest known tools come from 2.6 million years ago. But there were somewhere between 3 and 6 other species of people also around that time, so how do we know that it was Handyman who made the tools? Well, that's a very good question. We don't. Not really. The first evidence which we have for preserved tools used by people are stone tools. The oldest evidence of these comes from animal bones with cut marks and impact marks made by stone tools dating to up to 2.6 million years ago from the Gona region in Ethiopia. If you ever sliced into a bone while eating or cooking, these marks look a lot like the ones made by modern metal knives, although when you look at them under a microscope, they have a unique cross-section. This is also how we know that they were made by chipstone tools and not are just sort of random scratches. If you haven't made a habit of looking at bones over dinner, then think of whenever you've accidentally gotten a paper cut or otherwise sliced your hand open. These cuts look like that, but deeper, and on bone. Impact marks are the little cones that form when you place a bone on a rock or another hard surface and hit it with a stone in order to break the bone open. This is pretty common when we look at people eating animals in the past, as bone marrow is full of lovely fat. If you have to wander around the landscape trying to catch your own food all day, fat is definitely something that you want. We modern people have chocolate and ice cream, and our ancestors had bone marrow. Same idea. Anyway, these cut-up bones predate the oldest bits of Handyman yet found by about 200,000 years, so there's a pretty big gap, but then again, we don't know exactly how early Handyman evolved, so it's a bit less of an issue, as we know so little about the lifespans of most of our ancestral species, that there could have well been Handyman, or Handymen, around 2.6 million years ago as well. We don't just have the one set of bones with cut marks, but have several sets of finds of cut-up bones and also actual chipstone tools from 2.5 to 2 million years ago, so the presence of someone using stone tools is, surprisingly for archaeology, not an argument. These earliest stone tools belong to what is called the Oldowan tradition. We don't have a lot of detailed evidence for our ancestors, so mainly what we have is their bones, the bones of animals living around them at the same time, some of which have marks from being cut up and eaten, and the stone tools. So when your main evidence is a few bits of the people and one category of their technology, you put a lot of work into understanding that technology. The appearance of this stone tool tech also gives us the name for this time period, the Paleolithic. Lithic meaning stone and paleo meaning old, so we've now entered the Old Stone Age. As this is an early part of the Old Stone Age, it's called the Lower Paleolithic, or the oldest part of the Old Stone Age, which is a long way of saying that the way that people made stone tools has a name. Each time there's a different way of making stone tools, archaeologists tend to give it a new name. This saves time, in the end. Oldowan just means stone tools which were made with the aim of using the least amount of effort in order to get a sharp edge. In other words, you held a pebble of your preferred type of stone in one hand and hit it with another stone to ping off a flake of rock with a sharp edge. Then you pinged off a few more sharp flakes before picking them up and using your new tools. Sometimes we have evidence that people turned this parent rock, the core, around or over so that they could keep taking good-sized flakes off of it. Sometimes people were less refined and just bashed off a few flakes in a row and called it a day. Or, if you really wanted to go for it, you could take off a few flakes in a row on either side and make a chopper. You can probably guess what we think these were used for. Evidence of these types of tools come from North, East, and South Africa, so they're not just a local phenomenon. One of the big reasons for looking at the range of ways that Oldowan tools were made is that someone was using these 2.5 million years ago. Someone being the question. The someone question actually has two questions. How smart do you have to be to make these tools? And how smart were the various people species around at the time? This is why people get excited about Handyman's slightly larger brain. Was he smarter than the other people around at the time? Do you need to be that much smarter than a chimp to make old one tools? Well, one recent approach that's been tried was teaching a pair of bonobos, pygmy chimpanzees, to make stone tools. These were taught to knock flakes off of a core and then to use the flakes to cut things in order to get a treat. While the bonobos were able to make flakes, these were not very good. The bonobos made small, thick flakes, and the cores showed a lot of marks from failed attempts to knock off a flake. Oldowan tools do not show this. The process of knocking off flakes and making choppers in the Oldowan shows skill and preparation, much more like stone tools made by humans than anyone's made by chimps. These tools did not require speech to make, in the sense that you could learn to make them by watching examples rather than them having a more complex approach that would need to have the stages explained to you. Studies of the hands of both Handyman and Australopithecines suggest that both groups had the hand precision necessary to make Oldowan tools. Thus, we're left to argue about brain size. The answer, when we look at the available evidence, is that Handyman may well have been the creator of Oldowan tools. But he may not have been the only people species who did this. Until we find a Handyman skeleton actually holding an Oldowan chopper, arguments about this will continue. Even if we do find a Handyman actually holding an Oldowan chopper, the arguments probably will still continue anyway. The reason for this debate is meat. We have the cut and bashed animal bones, which show that Handyman, or someone else, cut meat off of dead animals from at least 2.6 million years ago. We don't know if they hunted and killed these animals themselves, or stole animals killed by larger and more intimidating predators. However, the concentrated nutrients, the proteins and fats, which would be available from eating more meat, are argued to have given our ancestors the nutritional boost needed to fuel the growth of larger brains. Brains are expensive organs, and big brains need a lot of calories, so figuring out who is getting extra meat and when helps us to understand how we humans evolved. The Oldowan tool tradition continues for a long time, but changes into a new and more complex tool group about 1.75 million years ago. This change is significant because it leads us to one of our most important ancestors, Homo erectus, or upright man. If you've heard of the out of Africa theory, then this is who you heard about. We know that erectus lived at least 1.9 million years ago, and we're fairly certain that he evolved in Africa. I say fairly certain because we don't know exactly when he evolved, presumably descending from Handyman, and the oldest bones which we've found so far actually come from Asia. Or at least, they were the oldest bones until earlier this year, when researchers working on material from current excavations at Dromolin Cave in South Africa published some new bones that they'd found. These were found over the last several years, but as is common in archaeology, they waited until all the bones had been studied, and, just as importantly, had been dated, before presenting them to the public. Dromolin is very near the site of Malpa, where Australopithecus sedebae was found, dating to about 2 million years ago. The bones found at Dromolin all come from one short period of cave use, about 1.95 to 2.04 million years ago. These are not more remains of sedebae, but come from both Australopithecus or Paranthropus robustus and, as you've probably guessed, Homo erectus. So our oldest known bits of erectus come from Africa, confirming that they really did evolve in Africa, as we thought was probably the case anyway, but we still had arguments. This also shows that, like Handyman, erectus also lived in Africa alongside other ancient people species, which were probably our very distant cousins. So, Homo erectus evolved in Africa by at least 2 million years ago, and was present until about 500,000 years ago. As he's called upright man, you may have guessed that he also got about on two legs, as have pretty much all of the other people species we've talked about. However, erectus was bigger than his ancestors. He was much closer to the size of humans, being about 145 to 185 centimeters, or about 4 foot 9 to 6 foot 1 inches tall. He also had a larger brain than his ancestors, about three quarters the size of modern humans. We have a lot of bones from Homo erectus, particularly compared with the other people species that we've talked about. We have some good partial skeletons, many heads and teeth, and a particularly good and almost complete skeleton of a teenage boy from Kenya named Nario Katombe Boy, after the river where he was found. These show us that Erectus had limbs a lot like our own, and a pelvis a lot like our own. Other bones of the pelvis found from Homo erectus females show us that they had a larger birth canal relative to the size of the pelvis than we saw with earlier people species. So the evolutionary changes that we see in people in order to be able to give birth to big-headed babies had evolved by the time of Homo erectus. By looking at the shape of the pelvis, the hip joint, the knees, the ankles, and the feet, we can also say that Homo erectus was a very good walker, much like we humans are. More than that, however, Homo erectus could run. Running may seem like an odd thing to worry about in human evolution, but it's actually a pretty big deal. Humans can do something that no other current species can. We can decouple respiration from locomotion. In other words, we can keep breathing normally even when our legs speed up. Animals on four legs can't do this. If you think of the speed of a cheetah, they are incredibly fast on four legs. However, once they've chased down and killed that gazelle, they have to hang around for a while before they can start to eat. That's because in four-legged animals, the motion of running is tied to breathing. I'm not talking about the all four legs moving separately trot, which is basically a fast walk. I'm talking about a full sprint, where the hind legs come up together to meet the front legs so that the animal can bound forward another stride. When the legs come together and then stretch out again, that's also the timing of exhaling and then inhaling again. Thus, the faster that the animal runs, the faster they breathe. That's why no four-legged animal can go at a dead run for very long. They get out of breath and they overheat. Humans can run at full leg extension and still keep their breathing normal. This means that we can run at high speed, or high speed for us, for much longer distances. We can also sweat while we run, which helps to keep us cool. This ability to run means that we can do something called persistence hunting. Persistence hunting is a fancy way of saying that we can hunt simply by running animals down. Now, obviously, humans cannot run as fast as something like a deer or a horse. Having four legs definitely makes those animals faster. However, we can run for longer than they can. This means that if we can keep them more or less in view, we can run after them until they hyperventilate, overheat, or otherwise just can't run anymore. Then they're much easier to kill. Running, therefore, gives us a way to hunt, which makes up for having soft little bodies, small teeth, and weak jaws, at least compared with something like a lion. Obviously, this probably wasn't the only way of getting food in the past. We could also forage for plants, roots, and fruit. We could also sneak up on an animal and try to get it that way. However, the fact that only humans can endurance run does suggest that it must have been somehow useful. The way that our hip muscles attach to the bones, the shape of our thigh bone, the large surfaces where the bones meet in our hip and knee joints, are all useful for running and all present in human-like way in Homo erectus. Thus, Erectus would have moved around much in the same way that we do. He was also pretty close to the same size as humans, with a bigger head than previous species, if a bit on the small side for humans. He did still have the eyebrows that we saw with Australopithecines. Those haven't gone away. He also didn't really have a forehead, with the skull pretty much sloping back from the big eyebrows. However, he did have a smaller face compared with his skull. His face didn't stick out as much, only maybe a little bit more than it does in humans, and his skull was a bit more round. In other words, if a Homo erectus walked past you on the street, you might see a slightly odd-looking person with big eyebrows, but you also might not have even noticed. Something else which makes Homo erectus seem close to us humans is the tools. Somewhere around at least 1.75 million years ago, the Oldowan tool technology developed more complicated versions of choppers. The rock with flakes knocked off on both sides to make a thick and slightly serrated chopping surface turns into a lovely, often teardrop-shaped axe. The development of choppers into this new axe takes us from the Oldowan into the Acheulean tool tradition. These show us that a lot more work has gone into making the tool, with planning and preparation of a big pebble of carefully chosen rock trimmed and turned around with bits taken off at just the right angle to make something with a wide and thick base which tapers into a double-sided point. You still get the simple flakes for everyday cutting. The really sharp edge of a fresh stone tool doesn't stay super sharp for very long, so if you're needing only to cut up plants and animals, then you really don't need a complicated tool. Just a sharp edge that you can make quickly, and make a lot of so that you have a new and sharp one each time the edge dulls. Of course, this means that most of the tools that we find are flakes, and the hand axes are much more rare. This does mean that telling the difference between where the old one ends and the Acheulean begins depends mainly on whether or not you found a hand axe. So it can be a bit complicated. In addition to stone tools, one thing which also turns up during the time of Homo erectus is tools made out of bone. These tend to be chipped in much the same way as stone tools, so we're not exactly talking about carved inlay or delicate bone needles. However, it shows that the same approach to technology is being expanded and applied to new materials, which is a flexible approach that we haven't seen before. The other thing which Homo erectus is known for, apart from the uprightness and the tools, is that he got around. By this, I don't mean that he dated a lot, although, you know, maybe, who knows. No, erectus is found not only all over Africa, but also all over Asia and Europe. When I say he got around, he really got around. Or maybe he did. Did you think it would be that simple? Once again, we come back to the joy of arguments. In particular, we come to Homo ergaster. Homo erectus fossils were found first not in Africa, but in Eastern Asia. When Homo erectus fossils began to be found in Africa in the 1970s, some researchers argued that they were not similar enough to the finds from Asia and should be classified as a new species, Homo ergaster. To add to the fun, recent researchers have looked at later finds of Homo erectus or ergaster and argued that we should assign yet another species, Homo heidelbergensis. The base of this argument is that we don't actually know how much variation there was between individuals of the same species in our pre-human relatives. This means that you get lumpers and you get splitters. Some researchers take a broader view and argue that the variation between individual fossils is not actually very big, so they should all be considered as one species. Others argue that the fossils show way too much variation and must be different species. We don't actually know how much variation we should expect to see in pre-human people. Added to this is the fact that these skeletons come from a 1.5 million-year time span and cover 3 continents. Based on some recent cave excavations, especially in Georgia, the country, not the state, it looks like variation in ancient people species could be pretty big. That is, of course, if we take those bones as Homo erectus and not as yet another new species. This becomes a very big headache very quickly, and most of the evidence either way comes from comparisons of small and detailed bits of skeletal anatomy. Essentially, even if we look only at material found within Africa, we have a lot of variation between individuals. There may be more than one species there. If so, then we may also have had more than one species leaving Africa and living also in Europe and Asia. Then again, maybe not. Homo erectus. Lots of variation, maybe more than one species. Homo ergaster may have evolved in Africa, left and then turned into Homo erectus in Asia, or Homo ergaster evolved into Homo erectus in Africa and erectus traveled into Asia, or they were both in Africa at the same time and one or both of them traveled into Asia. It's complicated. To save myself from the headache, I'm calling all of these people Homo erectus. I may be wrong, but I'm doing it anyway. What we can say is that erectus and or ergaster turn up all over the place. They are in Eastern Asia by 1.9 million years ago, in the Near East by 1.6 million years ago, and in Europe by at least 1 million years ago. This was not a small group taking a massive road trip, but the spreading out of populations who occasionally decided to hunt and forage and have babies in the next valley over from their parents and so on. We would have needed to have a reasonable number of erectus leaving Africa in order to get the species spread over such a wide area. But if your species is already present over all of Africa, then you probably have a pretty big population already. Of course, this might mean learning to live in a new landscape. One thing which may have helped is being able to make fire. The origins of people using fire, as with everything else, are debated. The best and most certain evidence comes from hearths, but these are mostly found from 400 or 300,000 years ago or later, and thus probably after Homo erectus. However, a prepared hearth, where you dig out a fire pit, line it with rocks, and have a fire in it repeatedly, would have left more traces. But a campfire outside for one night probably would not have left a lot of traces. We do have some strong suggestions of the controlled use of fire in and out of Africa, and presumably by Homo erectus, from at least 1 million years ago, if not 1.5 million years ago. Of course, we don't know if this evidence of fire means that everybody did it, or if it was only a few groups of people, occasionally, and maybe just for a little while. So erectus probably was able to use fire, but at the moment, this is probably. By any stretch of the imagination, Homo erectus seems to have been more successful than the other ancestors and relatives we talked about. They were around for at least 1.5 million years, expanded across 3 continents, figured out running, and probably learned to control fire. Also, they made very pretty hand axes. That should be enough to rank at the top of our ancestors. However, there is another thing that they did which ranks them pretty high in evolutionary coolness. They had kids. As far as we know, we humans, Homo sapiens, evolved from Homo erectus. Okay, there's a bit of a gap, and maybe they evolved into someone else first and then into us, but to our best understanding, these are our parents. Humans evolved in Africa, probably from Homo erectus, by at least 315,000 years ago. We humans were now in the picture. We were what is called anatomically modern humans. In other words, we look like we do now, with the big round heads, long bodies, long limbs, little faces, and finally no eyebrows, but only our regular eyebrows. However, what we don't have just yet is the other things that make us human. We don't have art, jewelry, or the other little things which humans make to show that we're displaying or expressing ourselves and our identities to one another, and which show that we have some cosmological belief or other signs of self-awareness. Anatomically modern humans may have had a rich world of myths and stories and social status, but we have yet to find any preserved human-made things which prove this before about 75,000 years ago. However, don't discount anatomically modern humans just yet. They got around too, including both all over Africa as well as outside of Africa. When they did, they met other people. These were not other humans, and they were not Homo erectus. They were also not Homo ergaster. Let's not go there again. Because one other thing that Homo erectus did, which makes them our best ancestor, in my view, is that they gave us siblings. Before we discovered early evidence of anatomically modern humans in Africa, there were arguments that Homo erectus evolved into humans outside of Africa and then spread all over the world from there, including back into Africa. This is mostly wrong, since we now know that humans evolved in Africa. However, Homo erectus did evolve outside of Africa, just not into humans. In Europe, Homo erectus evolved probably into at least one other species, known as Homo antecessor, as well as possibly Homo heidelbergensis, if they are in fact separate species and were not also a separate species who left Africa with erectus. Homo antecessor probably evolved in turn into Homo neanderthalensis. Our lovely cousins, the Neanderthals, were not the only sibling that Homo erectus left us. They also, probably, evolved into the Denisovans in Central and Northern Asia, and probably into at least one more sibling who we think existed from looking at our DNA, but who we haven't found yet. Thus, over about 7 million years, we have found a lot of grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and a parent species who may or may not have been one or as many as 3 species. This brings us to the end of our 7-million-year prologue. Next week, we'll start the podcast proper with a look at what we know about the first people to live in the ancient Near East. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me at prehistorypodcast@gmail.com. And if you would like to see reconstructions of what our ancient ancestors looked like, as well as their stone tools, you can find these on the website at prehistorypodcast.com. If you have enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and a review on your podcast platform of choice, and come join us next week for more Prehistory.